compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, welcome back. This is hour two of our program. We have 3 hours in toto, and I'd love to hear from you. The number is 888-914-9149. Cyrus, did you see the picture I posted on Twitter of Tesla owners watching the gas shortage?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that made me laugh.
The looks on their faces, peasants with their
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Combustion automobiles.
And their silly little problems.
Yeah, I think it's pretty funny, so... If you want to see that, it's there. I'm going to share a story right now before we go to the phone calls that doubles as not only an interesting story that might affect you, it might affect you, Cyrus, but it's also the perfect name for a garage band. Are you ready? You have a drum roll ready for me?
I don't have a drum roll ready,
okay.
No.
Okay, thanks a lot. Chicken Wing Shortage. That is a great name for a band. Chicken Wing Shortage.
All right.
Chicken wing shortage. Restaurants nationwide are worried over skyrocketing prices. This is from Q13Fox.com. Kelvin Dooley is having to contemplate the unthinkable. He may have to go boneless. His Virginia Beach restaurant, J&K Style Grill, is known around the region for its crispy jumbo wings fried to order and spiced up with the shop's trademark Kenyatta or Georgia Red sauces. You're getting hungry yet, Cyrus? Wings make up as much as, and we're not talking about the band here, okay? So don't get confused. Wings makes up as much as 40% of what he sells at his restaurant. His suppliers can't deliver all the chicken wings that he needs to run his business, even when Dooley can get a hold of the chicken wings. The cost is prohibitive, leading him to consider moving to boneless wings made from far more easily obtainable breast meat. He says, we go through 24 cases of wings a week. Right now, I'm getting shorted 8 cases, and I haven't run out because I can go to the restaurant depot and make up the difference, but they're limiting the amount you can buy. It's 3 cases here, 2 cases here. We have to scramble. Is there a limit of the number of cases of chicken wings you're allowed to buy, Cyrus, when you make a chicken wing run?
I'm wondering about these boneless chicken wings. I don't mean to cause a scandal here, but aren't those chicken nuggets?
You know, it's kind of like cat purring, you know, we don't know what part of the chicken that comes from.
Yeah,
I don't think scientists still have figured that out yet.
That's the same scientists that are working on the cat's purring.
You know what else I want them to work on? I want them to work on the McRib and find out why does the McRib have what look like rib bones in it? There's no bone in there. Have you ever bitten into a McRib sandwich?
I have not.
There's no bone, but when you look at it, it looks like 3 rib bones. You know,
wow,
find
how interesting.
How about science? You know, maybe the scientists could get into action and find out the answer to that question. Sarah Matthew, spokeswoman for Chicago-based U.S. Foods, a supplier for restaurants nationwide, says the industry is experiencing some supply challenges. Meat processors are having a hard time keeping up with increased demand due to a variety of challenges. Restaurants all over the country, from the Wing Barn in Texas to Chef Rich's Kitchen in Ohio, are reporting the same thing. The wings have flown the coop. Ha ha. So far, Dooley said, he's survived by backfilling wings from other sources. And I don't know whether he means like non-chicken animals. I mean, there are a lot of pigeons out there and crows. I mean, you know, with the right amount of breading and sauce, you probably couldn't tell the difference, is my guess. So anyway, this just goes into the threat of a chicken wing shortage. And it's a rather lengthy article. And it is affecting people all around the country. Now, this is not the only thing. I mean, gas prices are going up. Just look at the look on the faces of the Tesla owners. As they gaze down upon the rest of us who drive combustion automobiles, they're not bothered by it.
Have you seen the story of the people putting gasoline in garbage bags?
Oh, yeah. garbage, like the big plastic bags filled with gasoline.
Those cars are going to blow up on the way home.
That
is instant death. That is a terrible idea.
And I saw another picture yesterday, Cyrus, no joke, where a woman was just filling up tubs that had no lid on the top. It's just a tub of gasoline.
That can't be real. These gotta be jokes. They have to.
I hope they
have to be jokes.
I hope
they. Please be jokes.
I saw another one with a guy, a trunk full of chicken wings. I don't know where he was going with them.
And I saw I saw this house full of cats. All right.
I don't get that one.
Well, because moving on.
Yeah, better to quit while you're ahead. So the chicken wings, the gasoline, the pool liners, even something as basic as chlorine for your pool. There are more and more shortages now, and what's causing them, I don't know. I mean, I hear stories about, well, there was a fire at a chlorine factory, and that messed everything up. Yeah, but I think there's more than one chlorine factory in this country, and more than one place that makes pool liners. Cyrus, you cannot get a pool liner. If you were to call up the local pool place and say, I'd like to order a liner for my above-ground pool, if you have one, they'd say, you know, check back with us in 2 years, because we don't have one, and we're not going to get one anytime soon. It's that weird. So between the pool liners and the chicken wings, last year it was toilet paper. Let's hope we don't go back
in
that direction. Who
can forget?
I know. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Sandy in College Station, Texas. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning. How are you doing, Patrick?
I am well, thank you. Not too bad for a sinner.
Hey. So I have a question about the Orthodox faith. And my nephew's wife is converting to the Orthodox faith. I don't know if it's Greek, if it's Russian. I don't even know the difference. And so she's been basically putting on social media, because she knows her nephew's family were mostly Catholics and were mostly practicing Catholics, and basically attacking our faith. So she put in this quote from a book that's called The Orthodox Church by Timothy Ware.
I have.
And in it, it says, you do, you know it? All right.
Yes.
And
he goes by Callistos Ware. His Timothy Ware, when he was a Protestant, his given name is Timothy. But when he converted to Orthodoxy long ago, he took the name Callistos. So you might find that name in there as well. But anyway, go ahead, Sandy.
Okay. Well, the quote that she put out on social media, now, I know it was directed towards our family. It said, in the West, it is usual to think of the Roman Catholics and Protestants as opposite extremes. But to an Orthodox, they appear as the same side, different sides of the same coin. And then she had another quote where this one Russian, I guess, priest calls the Pope the first Protestant. So I know very little about the Orthodox faith. I always thought they were more like us, but obviously they don't believe that about us.
Yeah.
And now that we're starting to open up more in our state, where I know there'll be a family reunion coming up, I just want to be well-versed. I know this subject will come up. Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, what are the differences, and is there a source you recommend for me to learn more about this?
Yes to both questions, sure. Well, bless her heart. That is a very common polemic that is raised by Eastern Orthodox believers. I've dealt with it often over the years. Well, I shouldn't say often, but as often as I've dealt with Eastern Orthodox folk, more often than not, that's one of the claims that comes up. So you asked in a nutshell. It's hard to put this in a nutshell, but I'll give you a few thoughts. Number one, prior to the 11th century, the Orthodox churches that we think of today were all part of the Catholic Church. And you have to go back to the early 4th century with the Emperor Constantine, who decided that he would move the imperial seat from Rome to Byzantium, and he renamed it Constantinople. And that was the city that he created. There was a little fishing village there, but it was strategically located, large area with lots of supplies, easy to defend because it's kind of an isthmus. And he built this glittering, beautiful, grand city, and then he moved the imperial seat of government from Rome to there. Now, after that, he divided the empire into two. He divided into the Latin half, so there's like a co-emperor in Rome, and he was the emperor in the east. And what happened was, this began the phenomenon of the church growing apart insofar as geographically the center of gravity for the empire was in Byzantium or Constantinople, and the center of gravity for the church ecclesiastically was in Rome. And so there was a divergence. There was the divergence in language between Greek and Latin, the cultural differences. And eventually over time, and this went for centuries, it eventually got to the point where the expression of Christianity in the West was distinctively different from how it was expressed in the East. Now, I would argue, and I think the evidence supports this overwhelmingly, that there was no substantial difference in the teachings of the Catholic Church, both in the East and the West. But when, primarily because of political and also to some extent ecclesiastical rivalries and problems, when the Eastern Orthodox churches that we think of as Eastern Orthodox churches, when they broke away from the Catholic Church, they did so, and they had a list of reasons, and this is where the nutshell comes in. One of them was the complaint that the Catholics had added the phrase filioque in the Nicene Creed. So in the councils that formulated the Nicene Creed, the phrase filioque, that's a Latin phrase, it means "and the Son," where we say in English, the Spirit who proceeds from the Father and the Son, that phrase "and the Son" in Latin is filioque. And in the Greek original, as well as the Latin original, or the Latin earlier form, that didn't appear. So it would just say the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father. So the Catholics, this goes way back into like the 5th century. So in the 400s, we have evidence of Catholic bishops and others in Spain adding that phrase to the creed as a way to combat the Arian heresy, because the Arian heresy denied the divinity of Jesus, it denied the Trinity. So as a way to further establish the divinity of Christ, and also to do justice to the biblical proof that the Holy Spirit does indeed proceed from the Father and the Son. For example, in John 20, we see where Jesus comes to the apostles and breathes on them and says, you know, that he says, receive the Holy Spirit. So he sends the Holy Spirit to them. That's just one of several passages where it's clear that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. Nonetheless, the creed as it was used in Spain in Latin was a way to try to combat the Arian heresy. And when the Eastern fathers and patriarchs began to hear about that, they were really irritated, to put it lightly, because they were not consulted, and their position was, you can't unilaterally add something to the creed that was decided by an ecumenical council. You just can't do that. So that was a sore point. And so when in the 11th century, what we think of today as the Eastern Orthodox churches began to leave the Catholic Church, that was high on their list of grievances. They were also really, and understandably, really angered by the sack of Constantinople during the Crusades, when the Crusaders were on their way to the Holy Land to liberate Christians there, and they stopped off in Constantinople, and they raped and plundered and pillaged their fellow Christians. And that was a real sore point for them. There are also a few other things, like what is the actual authority of the Pope? Is he a first among equals, or does he have some authority that supersedes that of other bishops? So all of those things are part of this polemic, and quite frankly, the average Catholic like yourself, Sandy, doesn't think about these things, doesn't know about these things, and I would say very often just really doesn't care about these things. But in the Eastern Orthodox world, there has a tendency to be a very strong anti-Catholic bias, and it is preached, it is inculcated in the people that those Catholics, you know, they left us. We didn't leave them, they left us. So that's why you're going to see these kinds of arguments and snarky comments and things that are made in this literature. So you can expect it, because that's a typical diet that many people in the East are fed on. So what do you do? So I would recommend, you ask for resources, I would recommend starting with a book by a former Greek Orthodox who became Catholic. His name was Jim Likudis, Likoudis, and his book is entitled Ending the Byzantine Greek Schism. So in this book, he takes all of those standard arguments, like the ones that you're seeing on Facebook, And as somebody who left the Greek Orthodox Church and became a Catholic, he responds to it in a way that's very knowledgeable because he understands that world and what is going into it. A second book would be Jesus, Peter, and the Keys by David Hess and his co-authors. That is a book that pulls together on the topic of the papacy, because remember, the argument is that the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, is just first among equals, but he has no special authority over other bishops. Well, that's completely incorrect. It's easy to destroy that argument using the facts of Christian history, and that's what this book does. So it pulls together all of the major and many of the minor quotes from the Church Fathers, most of whom were in the East. So Constantinople and Jerusalem and Ephesus and some of these other ancient Eastern dioceses, and these are the ones who were writing and speaking and testifying that it was really clear in the early church that the Pope of Rome did indeed have a special jurisdiction that went beyond merely first among equals. That would be another significant resource. There are others, but I don't want to burden you. I'll give you one more, and it's written by an English Dominican friar by the name of Father Aidan Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S. And his book is called His book is called Rome and the Eastern Churches. Now, this book is a bit more scholarly. It is more scholarly, but it's very rich in detail in understanding the real differences and some of the nuances that are not always apparent between the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Churches. It's calm, it's not pushy, and I think you'll find it very illuminating. Catholic Answers at Catholic.com. They have a number of articles written by the late, great Father Ray Ryland, and he wrote a number of articles on a convert from Russian Orthodoxy at the end of the 19th century. His name was Vladimir Soloviev, and he converted to the Catholic Church, and then he spent the rest of his life evangelizing his Russian Orthodox brethren so that they wouldn't be so anti-Catholic and trying to explain things to them that would help them. And Father Ryland's articles are available at the Catholic Answers website, Catholic.com. Just type in Ryland, R-Y-L-A-N-D, and then maybe Orthodox, and you'll find his articles. So I'll leave it at that, but I hope you find that helpful, Sandy. There's plenty more where that came from, and you're always welcome to give me a call if you want to follow up on anything else. Sound good?
This is so helpful. Thank you so, so much, and I just love your show. Thanks, Sandy, so much.
Thank you. God bless you. Let's go now to Bob listening in. Oh, he's not there. Okay. Bob, I was just coming to you and you dropped. What can I tell you? If you want to call back, call back. But we have plenty of other calls to get to. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. When I come back, I'm going to tell you what everybody was expecting to happen as a result of COVID-19 and didn't happen. And it's kind of a drag that it didn't happen. I'll tell you what that is right after this. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Now, I didn't forget that I told you that something was expected and really hoped for to happen during COVID, during basically 2020, that didn't happen. And I told you I would tell you what it is. And I am going to tell you what it is. But at first, I've got to take a call just because it's easier to take this call first. Then I'll come to that. So I haven't forgotten. Let's go to Bob in Wisconsin. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Patrick. Our son has been asking us to look into a Bible, and he heard about it on your show. He happens to be in jail locally here, and he's going to be moved to prison. So he's looking for a good Bible that he's going to be able to keep. And he refers to it as called the St. Augustine Study Bible. Mm-hmm. When we go on Amazon or look for it under that name, we don't find, I find the St. Augustine Bible. And he keeps saying, well, it's the one by Ignatius Press. Mm-hmm. So I think you heard about it on your show and somewhere else. Yeah,
I think I can help. I think he's probably conflating two different Bibles that are both very good and both Catholic Bibles. The one is the Augustine Bible. That's published by the Augustine Institute. I have it. I like it. It's a new translation of the original Hebrew and Greek. And they were kind enough to send me a review copy, and I've used it and read it quite a bit since I received it. So that's almost certainly the one he's thinking of. But the other one is the Ignatius Bible, and that one is the Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition translation. It's actually the second edition of that. But that's also an excellent Bible. I have both of them and use both of them. So I think it's just a mix-up between the two different titles.
Okay, is either what does it mean if you refer to something as a study Bible? What makes something a study Bible, or is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be
really
the notes. No, it is a thing for sure. So a study Bible is a Bible that would have notes appended to it. So they could be footnotes, it could be introductory notes, but they're basically these are explanations for further study and prayer, as opposed to a Bible that doesn't have much in the way of notes. So that's really
more
what that
footnotes
means.
And things. Okay.
Right.
So it is. So the one I'm seeing here is the Augustine Bible. It's called the ESV Catholic Edition. So
that's the one.
We're thinking of. It's like 1,232 pages.
It has a blue kind of a deep navy blue cover with what look like gold branches from an olive tree and a Bible in the center.
Yeah, like a drawing of right, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's the one.
And the Ignatius one. So the other one is called the Ignatius Bible, and that's by Ignatius Press, then, or
yeah, that's why they call it the Ignatius Bible, because it's published by our friends at Ignatius Press. Their website is ignatius.com. The Augustine Institute's website is augustineinstitute.org. So you can look there.
If he's looking for something as more of a study Bible, or either one of these better for that.
I like them both. I like them both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think there's benefit for both.
Okay.
I hope that's helpful, Bob. I appreciate it. Thank you. All right. Now, as to what I was telling you a minute ago. So here's what some people were not only expecting, but also really hoping for in 2020, the year of COVID. And you know what the answer is, Cyrus, but if you didn't know, would you be able to guess?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you have a drum roll this time?
No.
Okay. What is with you?
I'm lazy.
All right. That's okay. You're not lazy, though. I know that much. Okay, so guess what it was? It was a baby boom.
No baby boom.
No baby boom.
Where are the babies?
People expect... So the demographers who study such things, and they know by looking back in times of... In previous history during other... situations where people were, because of natural disasters or wars or other problems, that they were not allowed to freely move about as they typically would, you would almost always see a baby boom 9 months later, because I don't need to explain why. Okay, so, but that's what they were expecting.
We talked about this, you know,
last year ago.
Right, and we're like, well, you know, if anything good about this, we're going to have a lot of babies.
Yeah, which is an awesome thing. St. Mother Teresa said that saying that there are too many children is like saying there are too many flowers. So we were hoping for it. We were expecting it. And it didn't happen. So this is a fascinating article at IR.org. The year 2020 generated several visible changes to the structure of our society. In the U.S., citizens migrated to different parts of the country. Workers changed or lost jobs, and education became virtual. One thing, however, has not changed. Despite expectations of a baby boom, from idle couples locked down together, birth rates actually continued to fall. Birth rates were already trending downwards in Western countries as more women focus on their education and careers, thus delaying plans for marriage or starting a family. The shrinking wage gap between men and women also incentivized many women to postpone childbearing to remain in the workforce longer. Now, these are, I would argue, superficial reasons for this. There are other more... maybe more problematic reasons for this. But the article points out that the U.S. birth rate has hit a 35-year low. The CDC notes birth rates declined for nearly all age groups of women under 35. It remained stagnant or flatlined for 35 to 39, and it rose actually for women in their early 40s, although numerically the number of children that that age cohort has is generally pretty small compared to the whole. But when state governments initiated lockdowns in March of 2020, commentators optimistically predicted an approaching COVID baby boom set to arrive about now because couples were sheltering in place together, but this baby boom has not arrived. CBS News reports that provisional data from 29 different state health departments shows that births actually declined by about 7.3% in December 2020, the biggest decrease since the baby boom ended in 1964. In fact, 2020 saw 50,000 fewer births across Arizona, California, Florida, Hawaii, and Ohio compared to the previous year. Now, here's the problem. And they get into it. So they say, okay, what are the contributing factors? And they get into some of the issues that they believe are probably responsible for the lack of a baby boom. And I won't go through all of these. There's some statistics and things, and you're probably, your eyes will glaze over. But the net result of this article is they just say it didn't happen. Now, this is actually a real problem. And it's not just sentimental reasons that drive people wanting to see a baby boom. They have a much bigger problem in China. And the problem is that in order to sustain a given population, the replacement rate for fertility is about 2.1 to 2.2 children per childbearing age woman. To put it a different way, if in a given population, whether it's the US or China or, you know, wherever, if the rate of childbirth among women of childbearing age is, let's say, 2.1 children per child, and see, that's an average. Obviously, you can't have 0.1 of a child. But averaged out, 2.1 is sort of the baseline. If you go above that, then all other things being equal, your population is going to increase. If you go below that, your population is going to decrease. Now, the reason we haven't really seen that in the United States is because the U.S. is a huge magnet country for immigration. We have vast numbers of people who want to come to the United States, and understandably so, because it is a wonderful, great country. It has its faults, I agree. The United States is certainly not perfect, but there are so many opportunities and so much by way of amenities and relative lack of violence and things that for whatever all those reasons may be, people from all around the world want to come here. So that has been boosting, you might say, in an artificial way, the numbers through immigration. Our population hasn't been sagging, or in the case of, say, China, in the case of Japan, it hasn't been collapsing. The population is set to collapse in on itself in Japan, probably within my lifetime and yours. You know, we're already seeing the same thing in Spain and Italy and France and Germany and Holland and virtually all of Western Europe. The collapse of their societies is underway because there just aren't enough children being born. In some cases, their fertility rate is down around 1.0, 1.2, 1.3, something like that. So we have dipped down in the United States in terms of births, and this article gives you all the specifics, but we've dipped down from long ago when we used to be up at like 2.1, 2.2 children per childbearing age woman. We're down now to like 1.65 or 1.7. And that is way below replacement level. And what that means is that every single year that this happens, even if it were to stay at 1.7, but it's continuing to drop, even if it were to stay there, the population of the United States, if you factor out the immigration that's coming in, thank God for that. Thank God we have that. Because if we didn't have that, we would be like Japan. We would be like Spain and Italy. I've spent a fair amount of time in Japan, and I've traveled up and down and around. And you know one thing you don't see much of in Japan? Children. You don't see too many children. You rarely see babies. Rarely do you ever see a mommy pushing a baby carriage in Japan. And whether it's Tokyo or it's some smaller city, it's actually, you know, it's something that you stop and you notice if you see a baby in a stroller. They're not having babies. at least in sufficient numbers. So in the United States, the problem is that as our birth rate continues to fall, and as, for whatever the reasons are, did COVID affect fertility? It seems that there may be a case for that scientifically. Maybe that the ravages of the COVID virus extend perhaps into that area as well, and it could be partly responsible. The jury's still out on that, but you know that could be one of the factors. Then you've got addiction to gadgets and video games. Then you've got all sorts of other factors that can militate against having children, not to mention the culture of contraception that we live in. So for all of those reasons, what we have been seeing here in this country is a net decrease in the number of babies being born, and the fertility rate is dropping and dropping and dropping. Here's why this is a problem. I'm going to leave it at this. Same time that the fertility rates are just falling through the floor here, Asia, you think Japan's got too many people? Japan is in a cold. I'm sorry, China. You think China has too many people? The Chinese actuaries, the Chinese demographers are in a cold sweat right now because they realize that they have a serious demographic decline in the not too distant future. They also have a severe imbalance between the number of males born and the number of females, because it was not at all uncommon for parents, if they found out that it was a girl on the way, that they would have an abortion because they didn't want a girl, because the girl would go off and get married and then she would have her family and there'd be no one to take care of them when they got older. So they wanted boys, and boys who can work and all the other things that went into that. That was the thinking or the mindset, not to mention the fact that the Chinese government enforced its brutal one-child policy for decades, which made it impossible for the average couple to have more than one child. And if the wife got pregnant again, she would be forced into having an abortion, to the tune of who knows how many hundreds of millions of children who didn't make it as a result of that. So the problem is this. In the not too distant future, because not enough people are being born, we have these huge infrastructures, these huge engines of economy, for example, that require fuel. And the fuel is the money that goes into this to make this work. That requires people paying taxes. It requires people working jobs. It requires people inventing things and manufacturing things and consuming things. All of that is necessary. Economics 101. For these engines of our economy to work, and you know, much less to thrive. And so with fewer and fewer people being born, we have another phenomenon that is taking place side by side with that, and that is, as our medical science advances, we see that older people are living longer and generally healthier lives as a result of our state of the art of medicine, which is good. I like that. I really like that. But what do you do in a situation where a society is faced with, like, wait a minute, compared to 100 years ago or even 50 years ago, we have like 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 times more older people who aren't working. They're not paying taxes because they're retired. They're not inventing things. They're not consuming things and buying all the things that they were buying when they were young and raising children. They're not doing that anymore, but they're there and they're eating food and they need medicine and they need electricity and they need shelter and the social contract that we have. Think of the strain on the Social Security system and all the other safety nets that we have built in, which are all very good. And then you've got fewer and fewer and fewer young people who are the ones who actually have to sustain that by their labor and the taxes that they pay. And there's a fewer and fewer of them who are in there working, and more of the older people. What do you think is going to happen? I'll tell you what's going to happen. There will be a renegotiation of the social contract. What does that mean? What that means is you got governments. So look around you right now. If you're in your 50s or 60s, look around you. Look at the 20-year-olds. Look at the 25-year-olds. Those are the people who are going to be in power, running our governments, running our, you know, all the infrastructure that we have in this country. In due time, they will take their places at the helms of power and authority, as every generation does. And they're going to be faced with a very difficult situation, because they're going to ask themselves, where do we get the money to deal with all the things that we need to do to support all the older folk. Why should I have to work more and more and more every year just to pay for them in taxes? I want to have some of that money for myself. And what do they do? What choices might they have to make when it comes to things like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and all the other great programs that we've got? That's the problem, because then you've got the specter, the lurking specter of, wait for it, euthanasia. And what I mean by that is, and I'm going to leave it at this because we have to take a break. Just game this out a few moves. Game it out a little ways. Game it out 10, 15, 20 years. And there are demographers who write articles and books and such, and they're doing that, and it's not a pretty picture. Because what this could easily lead to would be, okay, well, how do we resolve this problem? We don't have enough money. We don't have enough people. Well, we have too many of the wrong age group of people and not enough of the right age group of people. So what do we do? Well, euthanasia could be and probably will be a very handy solution, quote unquote. Because look, grandma, come on, you're 80 years old. You had a good long life. You had your fun, you had your chance, you had a good run. But, you know, you don't want to be a burden on your family, do you? You don't want to be a burden on society, do you? Well, we can make it very easy. You just drink this, you'll go to sleep, we'll all be there with you, everything's going to be good. And you don't want to be a burden, do you? You don't want to be a burden on your family, do you? Think about the incredible pressure that could be brought to bear on an already vulnerable population by urging them to do the right thing and take this pill or drink this liquid. It's going to be very calm, very easy. We'll all be here around you. We'll hold your hand and you'll wake up and you'll see the light and you'll go and be with Jesus. That's how it's going to be sold. That's how it kind of already is being sold right now. So that's why not having a baby boom in 2020 is a really big deal. And the more this goes, the more that problem comes closer. You know, objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. This problem is closer than it appears. Now, again, I did the Mr. Wet Blanket routine. I'm sorry about that, but it's an important topic and you need to know about it. And you may say, well, what can we do? Have more babies. Simply put, I mean, if you're married, proviso, asterisk, if you're married, have more babies, be fruitful and multiply, be part of the solution to the problem. Not part of the problem. I'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
We are back. Thank you for listening. 888-914-9149 is the number. Let's get over to Matt now in Wisconsin, Middleton, Wisconsin, to be exact. Hello, Matt.
Hello. So I'm 43. I have 12 kids, and that's over the last 20 years. So my wife.
Congratulations,
and I got married
by the
young.
Way.
Thank you. Bunch of them. I should say three of them are graduated high school, and so they've kind of moved on now. But in listening to a lot of peers at work who are younger, and even among some of my own peers, children aren't really seen as a priority for a lot of people. And by that, I mean, there's lots of talk about, I have to have a house, I have to have my cars paid off, I have to have my college paid off, and I have to have all of these other things before I have children. And, you know, when my wife and I got married, we knew we wanted to have children, and we just lived within our means and never had a problem. We didn't feel like we needed all of these materialistic things. And as I've gotten older, I've kind of thought about what drives that mentality. And it kind of comes back to that, you know, cardinal sin of pride. You know, it's it's about me and not about, you know, potential future souls. And I understand that everybody isn't in a financial situation and may have to discern that, you know, if they're in poverty and they really can't accept another child for a short time. Mm-hmm. But that's not really the case from what I hear among all my peers. You know, they've decided they're going to have one boy, one girl, and I always scratch my head on how that's going to work naturally. And, you know, we've just found as our family is larger that there's more love to go around. You don't have to worry about, oh, I've got to do this and that and this on this day. And one of the older kids is like, well, I can do that, Mom, or I can take, you know, Heinrich somewhere and I can, you know, do this. So I just think that a lot of people are missing out on the benefits that come with a larger family. And some of that's just because they have never seen it.
When you go out in public, Matt, with your, well, when you were a younger dad and you had all 12 kids, what kind of reactions did you get when you and your wife and your family would be out and about?
It depended. Believe it or not, when we would go shopping, like we'll give an example, we would go to Costco. We would get asked by people that, you know, we didn't know what their religion was. Are these all your children? And there were a few Muslim women who worked at Costco, and they would walk up and they say, you have such a beautiful family. I really hope I can have something like that someday. And that always strikes me that I don't hear that from Catholics. I hear it from Muslims and non-Catholics. Yeah. And, you know, we're always cordial and we're happier. It's like, you know, we hope, you know, that's something you can have someday too. But it's, I guess maybe being in Wisconsin and where we're at, it was less, we didn't hear put downs from people. It was more kind of eyebrow raises. Yeah. But the positive comments never came from Catholics. They always came from Muslims.
Interesting. Let me share my own, well, my reaction to what you're saying by way of my own experience. So you've got me beat, brother. I only have 11 children, but Nancy and I can relate to your experience. Our kids, it sounds like, are older than yours. As, you know, our oldest son will be turning 40 this year. But we can relate to that. And although I never really had, I don't recall hearing comments from Muslims like what you're describing. I'm not surprised to hear it because Muslims, culturally and by and large more so than Westerners, are, and I realize you're talking about Muslims who are in the West, but what I mean is like the values of the United States as a Western secular country does not highly value children, at least not more than the obligatory one or maybe two children at the most. If you go over the two mark, then there's something wrong with you. But it's to give you a sense of maybe encouragement, Matt, there are a lot of places I have traveled around the country where it's more and more populated with families that are large. So taking Columbus, Ohio, for example, where we live, I have at our parish, it is, you know, the Madrid family is no great shakes, let me tell you, because there are plenty of families who have 7, 8, 9 children. There are any number of families I could think of who have over 10 children. And maybe it's the parish where they sort of concentrate because it's really a wonderful parish. But for whatever the reason, I do see it around the country as well, where there are faithful Catholic folk like yourself who you and your wife are open to life. And if this is God's plan for your marriage, you're willing to embrace his plan. And that's a good and beautiful thing. So my thinking is that your role, in addition to being the patriarch that you are, your role is also to evangelize through showing that your family is not something out of reach, that it's not something that the average person can't do. They can do it. They just have to be willing to do it if that's God's plan for their life. And not everybody is going to be called by God to have that many children. But for those who are, it's a beautiful thing for them if they follow that plan. So even if it seems like you're, you know, an island in the stream, there are people who watch you and who are making decisions on what they see in you. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if in heaven some people come up to you and say, hey, you know, I never met you, but I saw your family and that really inspired me. And we have a bunch of kids of our own, thanks to you, and you're a good example.
Yep, I fully agree with that. What do you think the impact is from delaying having children until later life? It seems to me that the inability for society to put motherhood on par with a career as far as a rewarding life goal is a major contributor to population decline.
Mm-hmm. One of the factors contributing to that, in my view, Matt, has been the ravaging effects of radical feminism, which both overtly and, you know, explicitly and implicitly have hammered home, especially to women, that staying at home and being a mom and raising children is a defeat for them, that it is exploitative, and that they are not living up to their full potential. And, you know, it is true that for some women, motherhood may not be for them and raising a large family may not be for them, but for many women it is. But I think a lot of the hostility in our culture toward large families comes from this warped ideology that says that women are defeated, for lack of a better word, by being moms and staying home. And that, of course, is wrong, but many people have imbibed that through the media, through songs and movies and television programs and all the means in which this ideology has spread. That, I think, is one of the contributing factors. And there are others, I'm sure. If only we had time to sit down and swap stories, Matt, I'm sure we could come up with a lot of other examples. I have to press on, though. Thank you for the call, and God bless you and your wife. 12 children, that is awesome. We'll go now to Liz, who's listening in San Jose, California. Good morning, Liz. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for your show. I love listening.
You're welcome.
So thanks for all that you do.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I appreciate the time to chat. I actually wanted to respond to the previous caller and echo what he's saying. I think it's so important. Just a brief comment, and then I do have a question. My comment was, I came from, my mom was one of 11, and I was only one of two, and now I'm doing a lot of caregiving responsibilities of my parents' age, and I so wish I had more siblings to spread that around. But I also think that there's an interesting, I wanted to see what your thoughts were, Patrick, about the way that the father wound might like play into this. I have a wonderful parish, and our priest talk a lot about Dr. Richard Fitzgibbons and the father wound. And I wonder if there's a group of people now that don't have the healthy family and see that love. And maybe that's part of what also factors into people not knowing that this charitable, saintly family is a possibility. I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm understanding the question, you mean that because the role of the father has been distorted in the minds of many people, that they don't see fatherhood or motherhood, for that matter, as something to aspire to because of all the negative images that have been given to them through television programs, for example, where the father is typically the doofus. Mm-hmm. He's typically the one that gets made fun of. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. Or, you know, unfortunately, like there's, you know, many families that are broken or they grew up with, without a father, hopefully not within our church, but certainly they're out in the population. And so I think that when I think about this a lot, I think about how I wonder if that factors in. My dad had a brain injury, and so he wasn't able to fulfill some of the classic roles of like a strong leadership position, and that definitely impacted my trust in something that I work on. I'm thankful that we have all these teachings in our church to teach us that God is the best father, even if your father couldn't fill some of those roles that you expected of him. So anyway, I appreciate your insight, and I do agree. I think this is so important. I hope we have bigger families and more love and more saints headed down the pike.
Well, I'm so glad to know, Liz, that there are people just like you who are involved in, you mentioned you're involved in caregiving. I can imagine the opportunities you have to share these views with people, which I think is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a great point. Yeah, I'll definitely keep doing that. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you. Nice to chat with you. Yeah, just in the waning moments before we take our next break, we'll be back, though, with more of your phone calls right after this. But I'm reminded of some of the TV shows that came out in the 70s. So I'm thinking about Archie Bunker, for example. And that was an extremely popular television program, All in the Family. And Archie Bunker, you know, who was funny, but he was obnoxious and bigoted, racist. He was a mean guy. He was selfish. He was mean to his wife. He was a sort of a likable scoundrel. But the thing is, Norman Lear, the guy who created that television program, he knew what he was doing. And so in the personification, or in the person, I should say, of Archie Bunker, he personified all kinds of things, including the idea of the father being the leader of the home and all that. He personified the opposite of that. And so in so many ways, especially in television programs where the father is made out to be the idiot of the family, or there's some other way in which he's objectionable, that has an effect on people over time, and eventually that seeps into you and how you feel about things and how you look at things. And we're now seeing the results of that all these decades later. I'll be right back. Hour 3 is coming up right after this.